that was a courageous act, making an album where you're not playing the instrument you're known for. That you and I'll ask about the instrument, but I understand that you're a designer of instruments as far as that goes.
Yes.
You know, and
yeah,
there are other artists out there that were known, like Pharoah Sanders. He did that album playing a Cora. He played a Cora the whole album, no saxophone. Mingus, with the Oh Yeah album and the Mingus, you know, where he's playing piano. So there is
Don Cherry, Om Shanti Om.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and then Lenny Stern is playing an instrument you're very familiar with, N'Goni. So, I mean, this is a tradition in jazz. Led you, first off, I mean, what is this instrument you're playing?
Instrument. Ajua's bow. Yeah, and, you know, Ajua's bow is, it's sort of a mouthful, you know, to explain, but because it has so many sort of, roots. But, Ajua's bow is a 21st century double-sided harp that I created in 2021. It was sort of built to serve as a bridge to the African forefather nations of the blues and its descendants, you know?
Yeah.
Places like Mali, Senegal, Guinea, Gambia, Ghana, Benin, Nigeria, and instruments like the N'Goni and Cora. There are also sort of elements, components to it that are related to the methodologies of the Ankontin and Bolon as well, the Simbi as well.
Yeah.
But to put those instruments into a plugged in kind of lightning coming out of a Vox amp and smoking guitar pedals kind of way.
Yeah, I was picking that up because last night, see, I do a show every Sunday night where I'm allowed to, adventure, and it's spoken word, so I used some stuff off your album.
That's cool. Thank you.
I played most of the album, actually.
That's cool. Thank you so much.
And you were featured. There was some Wayne Shorter, and there was some Alice Coltrane, and some other poetry here and there. But, you were the feature. So, we gave some tickets away
Oh, cool, man. I can't wait to see those folks down there.
Yeah, featured your sound and everything. So that's an electric instrument. It's got a pickup.
Yeah, so it's plugged in. It's got a pickup in it, it's built based on these old world methodologies, but and it's still in the prototype phase, right? So Chief Ajua's bow isn't done yet. There are ones that I tour with now. We had 7 different prototypes that were built out. A myriad of different manufacturers did acoustic ones, the electric ones. So the record is actually layered with, every other song has different versions of the bows as well, right? So it's a process, and it was such a great time building the instrument because it also forced me to be a beginner again, These instruments are the kind of foundational instruments of the blues, but it's also high time that we embrace the fact that the 21st century is here. I think it's important that we start to build instruments so that this generation of children that are being born never knowing what it is like to dial a rotary phone and never to look through a yellow pages, they need things that are obviously newer designs, but also tied to the older way as well. And so we want to contribute those things. And that's really the kind of journey that we're on in the short term with manufacturing these ones.
Well, and your trumpets, those are amazing.
Those ones are different too, right?
Yeah.
We've had our own line of trumpets for the better of a decade, and all of them are technically not trumpets. It's like all of them are different ones. We have the Ajua trumpet and the sirenette and reverse flugelhorn and all these different horns. So, it's always been sort of a fun part of my practice to also go in and reevaluate the instruments as well.
So are your horns available out there in the world for sale if young players want to play them or buy
absolutely.
them?
Absolutely. They can go to Adams Brass or Adams Instruments, which is one of the largest music manufacturers in Europe. And I certainly think they make the best B-flats in the world, brass instruments in the world. And so if you're interested in getting any cheap Adua models, you know, you can contact those dealers that deal with those horns, and you can order your custom model with any of the different prototypes that we've made over the years.
Right on. I meant to ask you, what's the tuning on the harp? Is it like a Cora, or is it a...
No, it's a completely new kind of tuning. So it's a 3-octave instrument.
Uh-huh.
Each octave represents a different kind of culture of bow and a culture of harmony. The first octave is rooted in the Danso Ngoni, which translates as hunter's harp, which is, you know, for many different Mandé cultures. This is, you know, whether it's the Wathulu or Songhai, these kinds of cultures, their instruments are tuned pentatonically. So the first octave is built that way. The second octave is kind of a composite that gives me some sort of tension notes and rubs that kind of you'll find kind of readily available over the course of my records with stretch music. We have a harmonic kind of forecasting system in our template in stretch music. You know, it's like some people cite us as building a new type of harmony called a forecasting cell, but you can find versions of those kinds of cells in older harmony. But the second octave is built that way. Sorry.
Oh, great. Wow.
And then the third octave is just diatonic. So it just goes up, you know, in a normal diatonic way. So no matter the background of the player in the last octave, in terms of how the scale is built, they should be able to put something together. So
where do you
it
get
has
strings?
All three of those things.
Are you guys making your own strings, or are they?
What we wanted to do is to make the strings the easiest strings on the planet to find. So they're just monofilament neon strings. They're just fishing wire.
Huh?
Right. So now anyone that buys a bow or builds their own types of composites, they can go to their local Bass Pro Shop or fishing shop and get a string for it. So the main version of the instrument is going to have fishing wire. We will have different kinds of string over the course of the trajectory of the instrument growing, but right now I think it makes the most sense to make it as affordable as possible to people.
There you go. That's brilliant. Let me ask you, if I may, about your journey from Christian to chief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If whatever you want to share with us about that.
Or, no, of course you may. It's fine. Mm-hmm.
Especially about, you know, I know about your uncle. I'm a huge fan of his. And,
big chief.
Got to meet him. I just, such an impressive cat. Met him down in New Orleans at this place. And he was out there talking.
He's our goat.
He was, I was sitting at the front row, looking him right in the eyes when he's playing. You know, it's amazing. But he could see we were all, well, he knew Carlos from here. And, you know, just talking with him and everything, like I got the vibe about, you know, what he was about with what they call quote unquote, I don't even know if it's appropriate to say Mardi Gras Indians. It's black Indians, isn't it? Or,
well, you can, people do use both terms. It's not a term that our family enjoys. We've kind of been on the front lines of dealing with the shifting in the nomenclature.
Well, yeah, it's like it's a sort of a touristy, you know, kind of a thing when you say that, right?
When you say that, right, you're not acknowledging these people's actual histories. They're, you know, the fact that so many versions of these nations that exist have had to fight, you know, and had very, very difficult and tumultuous and traumatic realities to be able to maintain those, not just the cultural expressions, but just their identities at a baseline, right?
Yeah.
So to us, it is reductive to refer to them firstly as Mardi Gras, which historically is an expression that was black people were barred from. Mardi Gras was, you know, this is a space where, you know, all kinds of terrible things could be visited onto Black people if they decided to show up for those festivities in the past centuries, right?
Yeah.
The Mardi Gras crews were desegregated when I was a child. In the 1990s, the crews were desegregated, right? So to label them Mardi Gras is kind of interesting. But also the use of the word Indian in any context in the Americas is generally the beginning of things being mislabeled.
Yeah.
Right. So neither one of those terms really applied to the culture to us.
Yeah.
It just happens to be something that is a local kind of colloquial kind of energy that people use when they don't really know so much about the nations. The term that we prefer to use is maroon, because that is these are who those people are, and it's the way that their modus operandi is directly tied into the types of maroonage that has existed not just in Southeast Louisiana but all throughout the diaspora, the African diaspora.
Yeah.
Also, if you refer to them as Afro-Indigenous, those are acceptable terms because you know, generally in America, because we accept a sort of limited single narratives that exist around indigenousness,
sure.
we have concluded that African descent people do not get to enjoy indigenousness, which is obviously ridiculous based on what we know about the human being and its trajectory around the world at large, and the actual narratives in the recent centuries or millennia around how people have navigated the world. Firstly, we know the human being comes from Africa. This is not something that's up for debate. Every human being that exists in the world has the mitochondrial information that comes from the African woman in them, which means that they may be different in terms of their ethnic purview, but they don't get to be a different race. So to try and reduce the African descent person into only existing in one chasm is obviously absurd, because all of the human beings all over the world are derivative of that person. So technically they get to be any single thing they want to be, because they're the root of the thing, right? And now culturally, being that is different, right? So we know that Abubakar II sent over 200 ships from Mali into this region. We know that happens, right? We also know that most of the people that live in Southeast Louisiana, just as all the way to the Gullahs, if you go back and you look at documents of the French and the Spanish and the sort of colonial agents at that time encroaching onto these areas and physically taking the time to make depictions of these people, you know that they were also deeply melanated. If you go and you look up a picture of the Alabama or the Yamasee or the Choctaw, you're going to see people that were described as Ethiopian looking, right?
Yeah.
So also our relationship to like what an indigenous person is in general is that person is Black where I'm from, right? So it's like some people may look at an indigenous person and they may immediately reference something like, let's say, like The Last of the Mohicans and that kind of Hollywood narrative of what an indigenous person is going to look like.
Yeah.
That's problematic on a myriad of levels. Firstly, a Mohican is not an actual tribe. That was a designation that was created by the European author that made the book,
yeah,
right?
So there are no more. Yeah, James Cooper, Shutter,
right?
Cooper.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but my point is like, if we're being honest about to reduce it to the Africanity of indigenous persons in the southern part of this country, and also obviously in Mesoamerica and the northern part of South America, those are equatorial lands. We know that human beings that live close to the equator are going to be deeply melanated.
Yeah.
None of these things are up for debate. So the point is like to have this conversation as much as I have it in forums that refuse to actually acknowledge the shift in nomenclature, the shift in naming, the shift that this culture has embarked on for almost 30-year period to get to be called the right thing is kind of staggering. Like recently I did like a New York Times article interview. There was a New York Times article, excuse me, a review. And then an interview with the Wall Street Journal with folks that I've known for a very long time that have written about the music and doing an excellent job writing about the music. I mean, these are really great folks and allies to the culture. But in the in the articles they write, sometimes because of the editorial realities and different things about clarifications and people not being able to cite certain things without doing the deep dig, you'll see that a lot of these, the writers are relegated to still referring to the culture as Mardi Gras Indian. And so one of the reasons I prefer interviews like this and being in this kind of forum to speak to it is that it's not something that is up to, for debate my perspective on it, because the people get to hear my words. It's not something that has to go through an editor's desk two or three times in the back and forth where they conclude that they're not going to acknowledge my actual words and the truth of what we want to be referred to as, that what they're going to do is double down on deeply problematic terminology that is used to reduce an entire group of people that is made of a composite of 40 different nations into essentially being just carnival revelry.
Yeah. Wow. Well said, man. Well said. Thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you for the opportunity to speak to it.
Well, then, okay, addressing directly, your title as chief, is it a name or a title? Are you an actual? Yeah. That may be a stupid
actual
question.
Chieftain. No, no, it's okay. That's not. There's no stupid questions. This, I'm an actual chieftain, and you know, my first name in terms of like my legal name is Zion. X-I-N.
Yeah, gotcha. Right? Mm-hmm. And so, chief is your title as well.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. I recognize that. You know, because anyway, about the music now. Right from the get-go, I knew there was something different about you. You weren't just another young lion, as they were saying, you know.
Thank you. That's sweet.
You stood out to me, and I've always, it was right in my wheelhouse right away. I'm wow.
Cool.
And the album, the double album, man.
Oh, yeah, Christian Atunde Adjo. Yeah.
Man, to me, that was, you know, I'm going to sound like a fanboy, but to me, that's as important an album in the history of this music as Bitches Brew.
I
put
you.
It right next to Bitches Brew, man. It's
thank
just,
you, man.
You know, for a new century.
Just another template of fusion, you know, as the 21st century's, you know, kind of first real for us, at least in terms of how we're expressing and it kind of being related to a Milesian thing, you know. It's our kind of composite based on us hearing all of the things that they weren't able to hear, you know. But that record was an incredibly fun record to make, you know. That was I'll never forget Jamira Williams, the drummer's playing on that record, and all
bad,
the things that he was able to.
Bad man. He's a bad man.
He's a super bad man.
I'm
yeah,
telling
super
you.
Bad man.
Yeah, the New Orleans. That's kind of feeds into my next question. You're coming from this tradition, again, sort of a touristified tradition, sadly, where we finally got people understanding it's Louis Armstrong, not Louis.
Not Louis.
You know, this sort of, you know, I like how you put that as a sort of a you know, tourist thing that people finally are understanding with seriousness about New Orleans jazz. And how your journey from, I'm sure you growing up there, that's in your ears all the time.
Man.
How you develop, evolve into, you know, your music now. You know, how's that journey? And are you, you're not done playing trumpet, I take it. Or
no,
your
no.
horn, I should
no,
specify.
No, not at all. I'm looking at them right now. Yeah, it's... you know, being growing up and learning the music in the old way is, you know, it's important that that version of the curriculum around this music is maintained. You know, when you learn to play the music in our community, you learn in canon, right? So, you know, if you get around, if you're fortunate enough to be able to get around the master level practitioners. And you know, those guys are, and ladies, their approach to dealing with the music is to make sure that you don't skip steps. So the best way to do that is to really start at the beginning of the music, right? So when I'm a little boy, I couldn't walk in to, you know, maybe hear Wendell Brunius and Mr. Gabriel or somebody playing in Preservation Hall. I couldn't bring my cornet in there if I was 12 or 13 years old and say, let's play Donna Lee, which was written by Miles Davis in the 40s, right?
Yeah.
Like, they would say, no, Lil Harrison, you got to learn the Tiger Leaf Rag. No, Lil Harrison, you got to learn High Society. You need to learn Western Blues. You know, you need to learn Just a Closer Walk with Thee. So that they're going to make sure that you learn it in order. And what that does is it forces you to interact with the improvisational components of it in a different way too, right? Because each generation is adding a note or a tinge of feeling, right? Different things. So it's like, you know, if you listen to the early music, the spasm music, when they're playing turnarounds to get to home, they're not playing dominant seven chords, they're playing augmented chords, right? So,
yeah.
So you know, and that has a very different sound. If I play that at the end of a cycle, at the end of a musical sentence, that is going to, is immediately when I play it, if you hear it, is going to evoke old New Orleans to you, right? Whereas if I'm dealing with the cast that came out of, you know, a guy like Bird or guys that came out of Kansas City, you know, in their era and what they were doing with bebop, more of it is the tritonal relationship and how that actually gives a different kind of polarity to what the harmony is doing, right? So it's like they're different. So each one of those generations, they're very related. They're only maybe 20 years apart, right? Foundationally, but the notes that they're playing and how they're getting around are different, right?
Oh yeah.
So learning to play it in New Orleans and learning under those kinds of masters like Donald, you know. My uncle was the guy, and, you know, it's like he was lauded as coming out in that generation with, you know, Wynton and Terrence and Branford and Donald. You know, that was a movement in and of itself. But
sure.
Donald was the one that was really intentional about going home and making sure that the children still got the message, right? So it's like you can't find a player that's under 40 years old in New Orleans that's a serious player that hasn't studied with my uncle. They have to pass, they have to go through that test in order to be seen in the spaces where the most rigorous playing is. If they haven't passed that particular test, it's going to show.
Well, that's
because his methodology is built into all of us now.
Well, that's right? A familial thing, because whenever I've spoken with him or heard him talk, I got the vibe of a college professor. You know,
oh,
that,
yeah.
That he was always teaching.
He's a high master. Yeah,
I'm picking that up from you as well, Chief. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, well, I'm the baby still. And those things are there. I'm developing it, but my only point is just that, like, it, and when you bring up growing up in New Orleans and learning to play there, part of the idea is that, like, you know, there's things that I have together that, you know, in 20 years, there's going to be, hopefully it'll be a ton more. And then 20 years after that, if I'm fortunate enough to live and, you know, that long, those things, they'll be different things. The things that Charlie Gabriel, you know, in his 90s now, has to intimate about the music, he's forgotten more music than I've learned. And I'm a 40-year-old man that's been playing music since I was a small boy. So it's that part of the journey and being a part of the community and also being part of making sure to get those lessons so that I continue to carry the torch and guard the flame to be able to extend that information to the next generation. That's the part that I get up and really live for. But, you know, but currently the things that my uncle has been able to do with the language of the music and the approach and his ability to be able to create a system of disseminating that information makes him kind of a peerless guy for multiple generations.
Indeed. Yeah. Man, it's been a wonderful time talking with you. One last question.
The honor has been mine. Pleasure's been mine. Sure.
Is the band you're working with, is this essentially the band that was with you on the most? Oh, I need to ask about the title.
Yeah.
Because last night,
no,
I'm playing it. Get this. Last night, Bark Out Thunder, Roar Out Lightning. I'm playing this album last night, and guess what was happening? Bark Out Thunder, Roar Out Lightning in a big way.
Oh, yeah.
People were writing me, man, they were texting into the studio, wow, you're playing mm-hmm. this album at just the right time, because we were on
right. It's happening.
Heavy weather yeah. last night.
It's happening. Yeah, conjuring music, you know. It's, you know, that title comes from the proclamation that all of the chieftain in my bloodline give when they are addressing their nation before they meet the other nations, either on Carnival morning or St. Joseph's night, or, you know, a lot of times the processional will start with this sort of barrel-chested chieftain opening his ceremonial regalia and showing, you know, his prowess in a myriad of ways, and then letting the people know what they're going to embark on throughout the processional that day. And I grew up hearing my grandfather's really, really sort of a baritone, textured kind of a roar himself when he spoke. And it was something that, you know, has to be developed, and something that was like, you know, gives you a feeling that it's very different to actually describe what it's like on Carnival morning when the chieftain is doing that. It's like your spirit is meeting spirit is meeting soul.
Wow.
It's like that kind of thing. Your body does. I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking of it. But
down
it's
where
like
the
your
spirit
body
meets
is,
the bone.
Like, yeah, it's yeah. no longer your body. It's yeah. like you're more aware of your avatarness, and that you're a composite yourself when you hear those proclamations. So I wanted to call that energy up on the record, and so that's why it bears that title.
It's amazing. It's an amazing album, man. And
so thank you so much.
Well, it has been an honor and a pleasure, and
the pleasure has truly been
really
mine.
It'll be great to meet you. I'll be the guy sitting down in the front row. I'll be
all right,
one
let's
of them.
Get it. I can't wait.
Right on, man. All right. Well, thank you so much
for all this. And you know, honestly, I'm just really, really grateful and thankful for the time. I appreciate the line of questioning as well, and I hope the fans at home really enjoy it. This has been a real great moment.
Thank you so much.
All right, now I'll talk to you soon.